It is still dark, and the sky is a deep blue, almost black. Suddenly, almost without warning, the upper rim of the sun appears, and with it a magnificent reddish-purple color, suffusing the whole vault of the sky until all is aglow. This is followed by a gorgeous interplay of colors, all kinds and shades and tints, from the brightest flame yellow all the way to deep dark blue. Seeing the firmament alight with the handiwork of God fills my soul with ineffable joy, and a feeling of infinite peace and well-being fills my body with new vital force. How often I admire the sunrise from the terrace of our little house. Pure joy and delight feed the very depths of my soul. And my joy is all the greater because when we are here, Father belongs to me alone. Here he is not the Pharaoh, only my Father, my best friend and companion. Boga and the staff of life. One afternoon after a storm that has lasted for several days, when the wind has abated but the waves are still running high, Father and I row out some distance from shore to enjoy the waves that rock our little boat to and fro. Suddenly I notice something being battered about by the waves. It appears and disappears, rises up and sinks out of sight again. Father, I cry out. Look! What's that over there? Father glances off to where I am pointing. Let's row over there. He answers and starts pulling with might and main. As we approach, we can see that what we've spotted is probably the wrecked hulk of a sailing vessel. We see broken planks still clinging together, the snapped-off mast with its sail in shreds. Then I spy a human form clinging to the wreckage. Look, a child, Father shouts, starting to row even faster. It seems as if we'll never get there, but finally we do. A haggard boy of about 10 years of age clings desperately to the broken planks. He's already half dead, his legs hang down limply, and the waves pound his body to and fro. His eyes are quite expressionless and his hands, which seem to be glued to the planks, are all that keep him from sliding off into the water. Father tries to maneuver our boat quite close, but the waves keep beating us back, until finally he is able to seize a piece of wreckage and pull us up close. As he does so, I loosen the child's cramped hands, then together we draw him into our boat. He seems to be unconscious. Father starts to row for shore as fast as possible. Our servants have noticed what has happened and set out in several boats to meet us. Father carries the child into the house. Then the servants hold up the boy by his feet so that his head is hanging down. Then with powerful, rhythmic steady strokes Father squeezes the boy's abdomen and ribs together in order to force out any water the boy may have swallowed. Finally Father has the servants lay out the boy on his own bed, then sends them all out. Now I witness something very strange. Father goes to a little casket which I have always seen in his room at home and which he has always taken on his travels wherever he went. He takes out a little staff resembling a cross with a circle on top of. He holds the staff with this ring firmly in his hand and begins to make passes with it over the boy's body, moving it in one direction after another. I can see that Father is concentrating very intently, directing all his attention to the boy. First he holds the staff at the top of the boy's head for a little while, then draws it slowly over his face down to his heart, stopping there for a moment. Then moving forward from the region of heart, further draws imaginary lines over the boy's trunk to his genitals, then repeating the same movements starting out from the top of his head, he moves the staff along the boy's arms and out to his hands, then finally over his legs and down to his feet. Father has scarcely touched the boy's head with the little staff when the child draws a deep breath. Then, as Father moves the staff over different parts of the boy's body, he goes on breathing regularly, and his body twitches and quivers. Gradually he comes to, and by the time Father is making his last passes, the boy suddenly opens his eyes, sits bolt upright, to all appearances in perfect health. Then, without warning, he falls to his knees before Father, flings his arms around Father's legs, lays his forehead on Father's feet, and cries and sobs bitterly. Father helps him up, takes him onto his lap and dries his tears with tender loving care. the boy speaks a language I can only understand through spiritual contact. My telepathic exercises have developed my finer organs of sense to the point that I can understand the gist of his story without having to understand his words. The boy tells us that his father, who was a merchant in a distant land, set out to bring a shipload of goods to Egypt in order to sell them there. He took his wife and son along with him so they would be able to see what Egypt was like. After several weeks of travel, they were overtaken by a terrible storm. After days of struggle with the raging elements, the ship broke up and sank. His mother and several sailors disappeared in the waves right away, while he, his father and some of the sailors clung to a few pieces of wreckage. Then he saw his father, too, slip off into the water and go down. He clung tightly to whatever he could lay his hands on. And that was all he could remember. "Father," I say when the child has finished his story and begins to calm down, while I see in his spiritual radiation the gaping emptiness of stark panic and desperation, "the boy doesn't belong to anybody now. Let me take him and have him brought up and educated. Menu will teach him the language and everything he needs to know as far as behavior is concerned. He can get schooling and training in the temple. You see what a pure soul he has and how intelligent he is. I'll take him to the temple so he can develop his abilities. We'll see how he develops there and what he shows a talent for. Maybe he'll become a priest. Please let me take care of him." "Good," father answers. "You may keep him. The fact that you saw him and found him in the waves is a part of the faith that has linked you and him together for eons and ages. According to the inner laws of fate, he belongs to Y0U. While we are yet talking about him, the boy looks at us. Then, as if he had understood, he falls to his knees before me, throws his arms around my knees, and gives every indication of gratitude and confidence. I take the boy's hand and turn him over to a servant who gets him clothes and food. He eats with such a healthy appetite that it's hard to imagine he was completely exhausted only a few minutes earlier. As soon as a bed is made up for him in a corner of my room, he drops off to sleep instantly. Father and I go out onto the terrace. The surface of the sea is gradually quieting down, and we enjoy the play of colors at sunset. "Father," I ask, "what kind of force is there in this little staff of yours? What was it made of and how?" "It affected that boy like magic. He was half dead, yet after your treatment with the staff, he was filled with new vital energy." After some moments' silence, father replies, "Yes, the youngster really was filled with new vital energy. The secret of this staff is one of the secrets of initiation. We have to keep it secret because the staff can not only transmit vital force, but also can kill. If the secret of the staff were to fall into the hands of ignorant and self-seeking people, they would immediately use it wrongly. The time is already very near at hand when you'll receive your initiation, and you've learned to keep silence. That's why I let you look on while I treated the boy with the staff. Tahotep will give you a thorough explanation of the secret of the staff, and after you're initiated he'll teach you how to use it too. Tomorrow we'll go back to the city, and you will report to him again. You've made great progress in self-control. Your initiation is near at hand. After your final instructions, you'll get it." I am silent with inward emotion. My initiation is near at hand. The long years of preparatory exercises will at last be over, and I am to be admitted into the secret sanctuary of the temple. Initiated. In silence, and in a deep spiritual stillness, father and I watch the glorious, ever-changing drama of the sunset. Our few happy days of freedom are over so soon. Again, we are in the city, in the palace. I take the child, the poor little bird that has lost its nest, into my chambers and tell Menu what has happened. Menu's good, kindly heart goes out to the boy, and she treats him as if he were her own child. He points to himself and says, "Boga," and when we call him this, he rewards us with a happy smile. He is a fine soul. His body is slender, full of life and fire, resilient, limber and strong. He picks up everything easily. He learns new words and expressions in our language after hearing them only once. In the evening I go to Tahotep for some more instruction. As I walk there with Menu along the route that has become so familiar to me, I reflect that Ima no longer needs to wait at the door to guide me to Tahotep's reception room. I know the way, yes, even my feet know the way to Tahotep. Yet at the temple door, I see Ima's magnificent figure appear out of the darkness. His pure radiance fills the air all around him. I cast a stolen glance at his handsome body and check myself to see whether I could feel a physical attraction for him. No. I could never love him physically. I feel the loving tie that binds us is so deep it makes us completely one. How could a person love and desire himself physically? Ima too is descended from the race of the sons of God. He too has the elongated cranial form. He is pure, lofty, like an angel, spirituality personified. No, he could never love me physically, nor I him. Joyously I ask him, how did you know I was coming? Did Tahotep perhaps send you to meet me? Ima smiles, haven't you got used to the fact that a spiritually awakened person doesn't need external sources of information in order to know what a kindred spirit is doing and where he is? I concentrated on you in order to find out whether you had already returned to the city with the Pharaoh, so I could prepare your next tasks for you. As I did so I found you were on your way here. Tahotep is expecting you, come in. Tomorrow we'll be working together again. Ima goes and I enter Tahotep's reception room. Through my long exercises in self-observation and self-control, and through my long efforts to master the 12 sets of twin characteristics I have learned not to transmit my joy into my body, so instead of throwing my arms about Tahotep's neck, I radiate all my love and joy through nerve centers that carry my consciousness, especially through my eyes. I bow low before him. He understands and sees my conscious control over my expressions of love, that is, over the forces working within me. I understand and see that he understands and sees. And we are united in spirit. Oh! This unity is a thousandfold greater happiness than a physical embrace. I am blissfully happy in this perfect unity and wait to learn what he has to tell me. For a while, his eyes rest upon me, full of love and joy. His glance goes through and through me, unhindered. Finally he says, the time has come for you to learn the secret of the staff and the use of our other instruments. Your father knew that you were ready to learn these secrets, that's why he took the opportunity to show you the life-giving aspect of the staff. From now on you are to come to me each evening so that I can transmit the last secret revelations to you. The next day I am in the temple early, and we are all happy about seeing each other again. I love all the neophytes, and the master of the neophyte school too, this noble, loving person who never makes an unnecessary movement and never allows us to indulge in any lost motion either. Through his methods we develop wonderful control of the body. Through these exercises I have learned to transmit creative force corresponding to my degree of development, the power of my consciousness, into all the various parts and organs of my body. This has made my body so conscious and so vitalized that I can feel every part of it as distinctly as I can the inside of my mouth. Little by little I have learned, not only to feel all my organs exactly, but also to control them consciously. For example, I can now control my heartbeat. To do this I have to concentrate on a particular point in my body, namely the seat of the force that compels me to inhale. When we exhale all the air in our lungs and then don't inhale again, something forces us to inhale, forces us until we absolutely must inhale again. What it is that forces us to inhale is harder to discover than what it is not. Certainly it isn't the nose, which doesn't actually breathe at all, but is merely an opening through which we can breathe. It isn't our lungs either, for we can clearly feel they were merely working instruments in the breathing process. Finally we discover that a certain force, located in the region of the heart, causes us to inhale and controls our breathing. When I think myself into this point, I can speed up or slow down my heartbeat at will, through the power of imagination. Similarly, I have learned, step by step, to bring all the organs of my body under the control of my will. It's wonderful to have so much control over the body. Mentapta is very satisfied with my progress. He nods and gives me a warm and friendly smile when he notices me again among the neophytes this morning. After our group exercises, I ask Ima, "Ima, you've promised me a new concentration exercise." "Yes, listen," says Ima. "Up to now you've practiced your concentration exercises combined with slow, regular breathing in which you have inhaled the air and then you have exhaled it again. From now on, when you sit down to your concentration exercises, you ought to practice them differently. As long as you inhale and exhale, you're identifying yourself with your body. But the truth of the matter is that your body is really doing the inhaling and exhaling, not you. The body lives because the higher self, God, breathes his own breath into it. We're all alive because our physical being inhales the breath of God. You know that God is the self in you. Thus your body inhales yourself, you, and that gives the body life. As long as you believe that you are the one that's breathing, you're identical in your consciousness with your body instead of with yourself. On the other hand, when you experience in your consciousness that your body is inhaling yourself and then again in breathing out, giving yourself freedom, you can experience the marvelous transition out of the person, the animated body you have been up to the present, into your true self. From now on, as you practice, try to realize that not you are inhaling and exhaling, but you are being inhaled and exhaled by your body. With every breath you'll have the feeling, during inhaling, that you are filling your body with life-giving power and your body is inhaling you, and in exhaling, that you are withdrawing yourself from the body and remaining separate from it within yourself until the next breath. When you succeed in doing this, you'll experience something similar to the death of the body when you withdraw yourself from it and your body exhales you for the last time. Practice this a while and tell me how you get on. As Ima is about to go, I ask him to stay a moment, and I tell him how, with Father's help, I found little Boga and saved him. "Ima," I tell him, "I'd like to bring the boy to the temple for his training and education. Would you be willing to spend some time with him to see what he is particularly talented for?" "Yes, indeed. I'll be glad to speak to Mentapta, and he will take him in. He can live in the temple and get his training with the other children." "No, Ima," I answer. "I want to keep the boy with me. He has something infinitely loving and pure about him. I'll bring him to the temple every day and take him back in the evening. I'll bring him along tomorrow." The next day Boga comes to the temple with me. He doesn't know where I'm taking him, because he doesn't yet understand what we say to him, but he comes along anyway, obedient, with touching confidence and a radiant face. He is happy to be able to come along with Menu and me. I loved Boga from the very moment I first saw him half drowned in the water. He is fond of me too, and it's easy to see he is only really happy when he is allowed to sit at my feet. In the temple I take him through the long colonnade into the school of neophytes where talented children are getting their training. At first he doesn't want to let go of my hand. I understand that he's afraid I want to leave him here. I embrace him warmly and tell him it's perfectly all right for him to stay here, for I'll come and take him back to the palace with me in the evening. He doesn't understand my words and looks at me anxiously with big questioning eyes. As he sees that I'm not taking leave of him, he apparently quiets his fears somewhat and stays behind. When evening comes and I go to get him, I find Bogar is getting along famously with the other children. Making ample use of hands and feet, he is telling them something while they listen to his tale with the greatest interest, as if they understood him. When Bogar sees me, his eyes light up joyously, he runs to meet me, and throws his arms around my neck. I am delighted to see that he feels already so much at home. From this point on, every morning finds the three of us going to the temple, Menu, Bogar and I. As the weeks and months go by, Little Boga learns our language so well that he rapidly gains ability and fluency in expressing himself. He takes part in the early morning physical exercises under the direction of Mentupta. His body is alive to a surprising degree and the conductivity of his nerves is extraordinarily great. He does the exercises with tremendous concentration, revealing a great and innate control over the body. Ima loves him and devotes as much attention to him as possible. And the lonely little lad who has lost his relatives takes to Ima like a brother, with all his heart. He is grateful for every kind word. In the temple, the heads of the school have found out that Boga shows little inclination towards the sciences but lots of talent for drawing and modeling. That's why Imhotep, the great artist, has taken him into his studio as his youngest apprentice. Imhotep predicts a great future for him. Every evening Boga waits at the temple gate for me, and on the way back to the palace he tells me what's happened, what he has learned and what he has done with the other children. If Boga hadn't found his way so deeply into Menu's good heart, she would feel offended that he is allowed to talk to me on our way back to the palace because I never used to allow her the same privilege. When there were only the two of us, I made her keep silent so she would not disturb my train of thought. But she seems to take it as a matter of course that I allow him privileges I denied her. Tahotep's instruction, the seven octaves of vibration and the ark of the covenant. I stand before Tahotep and listen devoutly to his words. Today, I shall explain to you the laws on which the staff's miraculous effect is based. These are, of course, simple laws of nature. God is everywhere present and the emanation of his omnipresence is manifest in the visible, material world as natural law. Therefore, nothing can happen outside natural laws. Yet these laws differ from one stage of development to another. Different laws apply to the spiritual, the mental, and the material world. And in the material world we find different laws at work in one and the same form of matter, depending on the magnitudes involved. For example, it is a law of nature for the surface of a body of water at rest to be horizontal. But this law is valid only within certain magnitudes. A drop of water in the calyx of a flower has a spherical shape, and a microscopic being living in this miniature world would come to the conclusion that water always has a spherical shape. Why? Because the relation between the surface tension of water and the power which forces water into the horizontal is very different in a drop, that is, in a small quantity, from what it is in a large body of water. And yet, the same laws are at work. People know very little about the laws of nature, with the exception of those they have experienced in daily life. They have become accustomed to these and call them laws of nature. And having found names for them, they believe they know the true essence of the laws of nature. They accept these laws and their effects as a matter of course. But when they are suddenly confronted by some phenomenon they know nothing about, they immediately speak of miracles or magic. People do not realize that these forces are no less laws of nature than those to which they have become accustomed and think they know, even though they haven't the vaguest notion about their true character. For man doesn't know why a plant will grow from a seed or why a new being will evolve from an impregnated cell. Neither do people know what insemination really means and why, after insemination, the cell will divide and subdivide. They have no idea why this subdividing process is repeated again and again, not even stopping at birth, going on and on until a full-grown individual has developed out of that one single first cell. Then still going on until this chain reaction slows down by itself and gradually gives way to a decline. But since people experience this daily, they take it for granted and aren't the least bit surprised at it. Still, this growth of a plant out of a seed, the birth of a child, death, the different effects of the winds blowing from different directions, and many other experiences of everyday life are just as miraculous as the effect and the secret of this staff and the other miracles and the magic power of the initiated. For you truly to understand the forces used by the initiated and applied through this staff of life, you will first have to learn a number of things. When we spoke about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you learned that everything which has taken on material form is visible and perceivable only because it has fallen out of perfect unity and perfect equilibrium. But from this state of disjunction, everything tends eternally to return to unison and balance. Equilibrium means complete repose, motionlessness. On the other hand, to have become something that is, to have taken on visible, tangible form, is identical with loss of balance and with the constant urge to regain this equilibrium. It means incessant unrest, with continual movement. Should this constant motion cease, even for only a moment, all creation would suddenly be transformed into spiritual energy, that is, materially destroyed. All energy, all the forces of the universe, are movements which emanate from one point, their own center, and radiate in circular waves in all directions, manifesting themselves as vibrations or oscillations. These manifestations of force cease only when the forces that have got out of balance regain their primordial state of equilibrium, the divine unity. Hence, when we speak of the primordial state, we mean the state in which all material phenomena have ceased to exist. In its true essence, matter, too, is motion. And if this motion comes to a stop, matter must necessarily cease to exist. As long as the three-dimensional, material world exists, its immutable law is that of unrest, of movement. The fact that the creative force manifests itself on each and every level of innumerable possibilities means there are countless different wavelengths, waveforms, and frequencies. And as long as we are in the body, with its limited perceptive ability, we can perceive only a certain number of these waveforms because our organs of sense are limited. Whether some form of vibration appears to us as immaterial energy or as solid matter depends upon our own idea and the impression of something which is basically nothing but movement, vibration, or frequency. The shorter the waves in which a form of energy manifests itself, the less our consciousness records a sensation of matter. To the vibrations that are transmitted directly to our consciousness by our organs of sense, we give names according to the sensations we feel: matter, sound, electricity, heat, taste, smell, light. The still higher, immaterial energies and radiations, perceptible only by means of our brain and nerve centers, we call thought waves, idea waves. Beyond them, there are still higher, more penetrating rays and frequencies, all the way up to the very highest all-pervading frequencies of the divine creative power, life itself. We can only perceive these frequencies as a state of consciousness. So, throughout the universe, countless varieties of vibrations are at work, ranging from the shortest to the longest wavelength. Every form of creation, beginning with the celestial bodies and ranging all the way down to the tiniest monocellular creature, all the myriad manifestations of creation are the effects of various forms of these rays. We live in these various rays whether we know it or not. Even more, these forms of energy have built and formed us human beings and are constantly at work in our body, our mind, and our entire being. The whole universe consists of these various vibrations. The source of these creative vibrations we call God. God Himself stands above all manifestations of life and rests in Himself in absolute equilibrium without time and without space. But He is constantly radiating Himself out into material forms in order to give these forms life. As God is omnipresent and fills the entire universe, everything that is in the universe is penetrated and filled by God. Nothing can exist without being in God and without God's penetrating it, as God is everywhere present and nothing can displace or dislodge Him from His own presence. Consequently, every point offers a possibility that God may manifest Himself through it, and everything that exists in our perceptible world carries this point as its own center within itself. From this point, there began its first manifestation, its creation, its fall from equilibrium. This aspect of God who creates the material world and gives it life by penetrating it, that is, the actual life high us and in all creatures, we call the higher self. Expressions like God, Creator, Universal Self, Higher self or the creative principle all mean one and the same divinity in its various aspects. The energies radiating from the center are still highly spiritual in the center and of the highest frequencies. But the farther out they radiate from the center, the more material they become. Until these radiating energies are gradually changed into matter,